Under the skin. That's an appropriate song to play for a fish podcast, such as Under the Scales. I want to have a friend tell a little bit about the background of that track and how it came about.
Well, Tom, that was J-Rad, also known as Joe Russo's Almost Dead, playing at Red Rocks last week, and we were playing a Grateful Dead song called Slipknot, and out of Slipknot, we just started doing the hits. Those are the ones. And the crowd started to sing the appropriate lyrics back at us.
Wilson.
To the fish song Wilson. And what you just heard was that. That happened last week at Red Rocks.
That's amazing.
J-Rad ended up playing Wilson, and the crowd was right there with us 150%.
Unbelievable.
It was unbelievable.
That is a great intro to this podcast.
Hey guys, we're back. Under the Scales has an amazing interview with my pals Scott and Andrew coming right up. But first, let me tell you about something happening at the Dix shows in Denver next weekend. I feel there's unprecedented anticipation built up for these shows, especially after the Curveball Festival cancellation. I know a lot of people who weren't going to Dix have now changed their plans and are descending upon Commerce City, Colorado in droves. So that's what I want to talk about for just a minute. In a recent episode of my other podcast called State of the Garden, a discussion about New Jersey's cannabis legalization effort, which is currently underway, I interviewed a great guy whose name is Peter Barsoom. Peter founded an amazing cannabis edibles company called 1906, based in Denver. Coincidentally, Peter went to the same high school Trey and I did, Princeton Day School. Peter eventually opened his company, 1906, in Denver. But I interviewed him because he's thinking of opening up also in New Jersey. Peter and Osiris, our podcasting parent company, are talking about 1906 becoming a new sponsor on all Osiris podcasts. It turns out that Peter is a fish fan and also has a bunch of fish fans in his company. We are everywhere. They are also fans of my old band Amphibian. When we talked off the record about Amphibian not being completely inactive, meaning we're still writing songs and are thinking about releasing an album, maybe doing a reunion show, we got the idea to do a limited release of some of Peter's products next weekend in Colorado as Amphibian versions. I'm so honored by this. So 1906 creates incredible edible experiences. It's not just, here's some chocolate with this much THC in it. Instead, 1906 focuses on the journey. They have six different journeys you can experience right now, and they're named Go for Energy, Pause for Relaxation, Midnight for Sleep, Bliss for Happiness, and High Love for Arousal, and soon Present for Focus and Concentration. They combine the best marijuana strains and carefully adjust ratios and combine it with other plant medicines to achieve these amazing results. They took two of my favorites, Go and Bliss, and created a special Amphibian limited edition of these, which are available in stores around the Dix Arena starting today, Monday, August 27th, and remaining on sale until they're gone. Info on these stores can be found at 1906 New Highs on Twitter. You can also find info in the Bliss Lounge on Dix Lot on Saturday and Sunday. Come by in the afternoon and I'll be there with Peter. It's a Moroccan-themed tent where you can get out of the sun, get some fish-inspired face art, and I'll sign some 1906 boxes for you guys. Thanks, 1906. Next up, we have something I've been giving as a gift to family members, and they've been loving it. It's called Masterclass. Masterclass is an Osiris sponsor who offers online video classes taught by the best teachers in the world. Some of you asked me if I really use Masterclass, and the answer is definitely yes. My favorite so far, I watched a bunch of directors and writers. I can't get enough of that stuff. So Judd Apatow, Ron Howard, Martin Scorsese, R.L. Stein, the author, Aaron Sorkin, the West Wing screenwriter, and also Newsroom, two of my favorite TV shows of all time, James Patterson, the writer, all of these people teaching you directly how they do what they do and how to emulate their success. Whether you're emulating or just interested in these people, Masterclass has created these amazingly high-def video classes. Each one is shot with cinematic production quality and offers on-demand lessons loaded with exclusive content you'll only find on Masterclass. You can choose from classes taught by over 35 masters, and new classes are always being added. Whether you're pursuing your passion or developing your career, you'll find a masterclass for you. Under the Scales, listeners can unlock access to every masterclass for 1 year right now for a very low price. Go to masterclass.com/scales. That's masterclass.com/scales. Thanks, Masterclass.
Scott, you were talking about bulletproof coffee. He brought a thermos that actually looks like a flashbang grenade or something, and I don't even know what it is.
I thought it was an Alexa.
Yeah, or his own personal portable Alexa.
It just logs it in. But it turns out
that it opens and there's liquid in there, but not there normal is. Liquid.
There's coffee in there, and there's also a lot of butter in there mixed in with the coffee and coconut oil, and that's a thing called bulletproof coffee.
And what does that do for you?
It gives you tons of energy, and you never get hungry because of the sustainable fats in the butter.
So it covers all bases, tired and hungry.
Yes, absolutely. I haven't eaten in months. I live off butterproof, bulletproof coffee now.
Really?
It's like just once a day, or is it like like for lunch and dinner as well?
I think it's supposed to be once a day, but I do it all day, every day, kind of. Like, I'll have like two or three of these every day. And I can't really get through a gig without one.
Really?
I bring this thermos. There have actually been nights where I've walked out on stage and I've forgotten the thermos backstage. And I call Evan, our tech, over, and I'm like, thermos. And he knows, like, I left it backstage, and he runs backstage.
Wow. Does he know the ratio? Does he know the formula in case you're running low and the gig, you know?
No, but that's a good idea.
The show must go on, right?
The show must go on.
He should know the ratio. The golden ratio.
We're going to have a talk about this.
All right. Well, so I'm your host of Under the Scales. Welcome to Under the Scales. The Under the Scales studio is in Princeton, New Jersey, as usual. And I have two wonderful guests, one of them sort of functioning as a co-host, and one of them is sort of the featured guest. You've heard the name Scott. We will give him a last name in a moment. But first, let me remind you that Under the Scales is a proud member of the Osiris family of podcasts. If you like this podcast, go to osirispod.com and check out other music and culture podcasts. And soon, our new subcategory, cannabis. We're getting one or two new cannabis podcasts. Check out osirispod.com. Thank you. And so I'm in the room here with Andrew Southern. Hey, Andrew.
Hi.
And I'm in the room here with Scott Metzger. How you doing?
Good. Good to see you.
Yeah, thanks for coming down. So Scott is, these both are friends of mine from a long time. Both of them were in Amphibian. And my band that started in 1999, and these guys were in the first, I call it Amphibian 1.0, and in the second version, I call it Amphibian 2.0. Amphibian went on to have 3.0 and 4.0, and finally went defunct in 2006. But you guys were in there for the formative years, and you were also simultaneously in a band called Rana, and we sort of found Scott thrashing around in a jazz kind of trio called F-Hole. I want to talk about all this and play some of that amazing music, but also follow your amazing trajectory, Scott, which now has you as one of the main guitarists and you know, front men almost, right? I don't know almost, exactly how to say it, of J-Rad, which is, of course, the huge Grateful Dead-based band.
Right. Joe Russo's almost dead.
Yeah. Joe Russo's almost dead. Yeah. So I'd love to go through that with you and also talk about some of the, you know, fun times we had on the way.
Sounds great.
Awesome. So how do we start? How do we start? I mean, I think I got to know you, Andrew, through Princeton Day School.
Yeah, I reached out through someone at Princeton Day School and was like, I'm going to do this thesis and I want to work with an alum. I want to work with Tom Marshall because I was a huge Fish fan. And I was like, this would be great. And then you said
yes. Probably wasn't available.
And then you said yes. And then we ended up making a record in your basement.
Maybe I was looking for my tie. Stumbling through the gutter with the traffic rushing by. Maybe I was waiting for a ride. Let it pass on by and kept looking for my pride.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
And then at the time, and I'm going to be a little muddy with this, we met somewhere around there. And I remember so clearly going to, what's the coffee shop? Small World Coffee Shop.
Yeah.
On Witherspoon Street. And it was F-hole. And I went to go see you play. And you were in the upper part with Trey. So it was like you and Trey.
So that was the night that we met. I remember that night.
We were all there, right? And I just remember that so clearly, being like, oh my God, this guy's amazing. And like Trey's here to see this guy. It was like so exciting.
Yeah.
So F-hole at the time, why don't you tell a little bit about that and how you got into F-hole? Because F-hole had my friend Matt Cohut as the bass player.
Yes. And you guys went to school together, right?
Matt was in... Was he in my grade? Was he in Trey's in my grade? Or was he one below
I think it was close. Yeah. If you guys weren't in the same grade.
I think he was really 1 year younger. But he, you know, I've spoken before about how musical Princeton Day School was. And Matt Cohut was one of, although he was an echelon above just the run of the mill, he was like a more talented and a more studious bass player who was like definitely taking it more seriously than everyone else. So every now and then he would wind up sort of co-collaborating with us in some way. Trey knew him. He knew Trey. He knew me. But unbeknownst to me, he created a band called F-Hole. And how did he find you, Scott?
Well, I don't remember exactly how we met, but we were both... I grew up in a really small town in Jersey called Lambertville, New Jersey. And it's like a small river town. And Matt was living in Lambertville at that time. And I don't remember exactly how we met or, you know, when we first played together or anything. But I know that when we did play together, we both knew that we had a musical connection that made a lot of sense. And we started talking about bands and we loved both this, you know, everybody loved the same bands. And he said to me that he had a friend who was living in Brooklyn who played drums, and that turned out to be JP Wasico. And the three of us, me and Matt, drove into the city one day to Mott Street, and it was like a basement rehearsal space that JP had in the city. And I still walk by. I live in New York now, and I still walk by that rehearsal space from time to time.
That's where it all started for you, kind of.
That's where it all started. Yeah, that's like so cool. We're sitting here because of that rehearsal space.
No question.
You know?
Yeah, no, exactly. You can draw directly. Like some people don't have exactly that firm root of their, you know, rooted in their timeline.
Right. You can't like pinpoint the thing, you know, right. But that's definitely, that was the room, you know, that was the room. And we just started playing, and immediately we knew, and we sort of went for it was an instrumental band. And it was very sort of experimental and...
Maybe we should hear a little bit of F-Hole right now.
Maybe we should. If we can do that, that'd be great.
Let's do it. Wow, that's great. So
thanks, Tom.
Killer.
How old were you, by the way, at the time? You were very young.
I was young. I don't think that I was 20.
Yeah. No, I don't think you were either. I remember you in Amphibian, and I don't think you were 20. Maybe you were 20.
Just turned 20.
Maybe, yeah, but you weren't legal to drink.
It was barely legal.
Yeah. That's a great little solo there, kind of showing your jazz sort of feeling, your jazz tendency a little bit.
It was in there. It was in there from an early age,
yeah,
for sure.
And how did that come about? Did you sort of have training in that regard?
I did. I went to college for jazz guitar. In high school, my high school was so small, there wasn't much to do. I went to the smallest public high school in New Jersey. I graduated with 28 kids in my class from a public high school. And I knew as soon as I picked up the guitar, I knew that that's what I wanted to do. And I also knew that I wanted to go to college. And I learned really quickly that if you wanted to go to college while playing guitar, it needed to be for playing jazz. That was like pretty much your only option.
Right. There's no like, you know, pop guitar.
There might be
classes.
Now. Well, like, I don't know, Berkeley. I don't know what they do.
Well, the
there.
Weird thing is, music now doesn't have guitar in it. Guitar bands are obviously still immensely popular, but the new music are no longer guitar driven.
It's true.
I think you're right. I mean, I was thinking about this. The popular music that I can think of with guitar is like John Mayer and Muse.
True.
You know, or like guitar, both of those bands have guitarists, right? Like sick guitar players.
True.
But you're right. Like generally speaking, you can turn on the radio. It's not a lot of guitars.
Right. And if like Taylor Swift writes a song on a guitar, it's like an acoustic strummy thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like hair band with a raging solo.
Right.
Stairway to Heaven solo. Those are gone. It's kind of left.
But then like the jam band scene is the total opposite of that.
It is. It's just going into a 20-minute trance. And it's all guitar driven.
It's just here it comes.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like it's gonna be a solo. Pretty much.
And you're ready to deliver that, right?
Yeah, that's why I'm here.
Yeah. So Scott brought his guitar. So that's kind of F-hole. And then we met shortly after that, and I say we collectively, because the three of us, like Andrew had said, you found Scott, like we were all in that room with Trey at Small World Coffee on Witherspoon Street in Princeton. I think I went with Trey because Matt Koha was our friend and we knew he had a band. And I think we had heard a little bit about his cool guitar player.
Okay, right.
Right? So we saw you. Did you know who Trey was at the time? Did you know Trey? Did you know that there was a redhead that was causing a sensation
of a redhead causing a sensation
in the building.
I got to admit, I didn't know exactly who he was.
You didn't
at the time.
Interview over.
It was good seeing everybody.
Grab your Alexa and go.
No, I can imagine that you probably didn't. Right? I mean, that's pretty interesting. Was he kind of being a magnet? Like, were people?
Well, you could tell. I mean, well, I was playing. You know, so when because Matt leaned over to me and he was like, Trey's here, you know,
and you're like, I don't care.
I don't know how to feel about that, you know. So I was playing, but you know, and I kind of had one eye on the table where you guys were at from that point on, and I could see that people were coming up and like asking for autographs or whatever. They were just saying hello. Yeah,
yeah. This was pre-selfie, back when autographs were a thing.
That's right. Totally. It totally was.
So then somehow. I mean, not to take the spotlight off of Scott, but if I remember my timeline, Matt and I kind of got summoned by Trey up to Vermont. And the idea was that we were going to form a band called U-Talk, U-T-A-L-K.
Right.
And so Matt and I drove up and we practiced a few songs. And there was another guitarist there, and I kind of don't remember who that was. So it was like the four of us were going to be a band, and the chemistry just, it was one of those, it honestly, one of the first times ever with Trey where everything just sort of fell flat. It just, nothing worked.
Yeah.
Our songs sounded like shit. Everything sounded like crap. There was no chemistry with any of the members. And Matt and I, as we drove home, we said, you know what? That's never going to happen. We're going to have to form our own band. And right then is when Amphibian began.
It was a blessing that it didn't work out. Yeah, right.
Yeah. And I said, well, what about, you know, how do we replace Trey. I mean, that's like our big, that's our big guitarist. That's our big thing. And he's like, well, I got a guy. And that was you, Scott.
Big shoes.
Yeah.
Big shoes to fill.
Yeah, man. And you did. I mean, that we had a really good band. Let's hear a little very early Amphibian right now. This song's called The Onion. And I think it was written by me, Matt, and possibly Scott. And JP's in there. And Scott's solo at the end is kind of, you finally get to the prize, which is sort of the outro, which is what we're going to play right now.
Into the drain.
That kind of gives another idea, and that one still is sort of F-hole sounding.
It is, yeah. It's funny. I remember when we recorded that song, like it was last week, like the exact moment.
Really,
like we were up in the house, up in the little the attic.
Let's right? also That's play. Just now, it occurred to me that it kind of might make sense. We were sort of kind of touring with the Sarahs. You sort of had a little brief romance with Stephanie of
right.
the Sarahs, and you wrote a song, and it's a very cute song.
Oh, yeah, in case you didn't know it.
In case you didn't know it.
Oh, let's, I haven't
thought
about that.
Let's hear a little bit about that one. A little bit of that one.
There is a barn in central New Jersey. That's where I met my love. Where the children play all day. And the old folks waste away, and the stars play in the skies up above. When I first met her, it was 98. She was looking good, she was looking great. Well, little Anna sat on Big Tom's knee. A voice said, hello, I'm Stephanie. And that's when it all began. That's when my troubles turned to sad, and I could stop singing my blues. Lately I've been thinking a lot
thinking
about that Stephanie and Scott. And in case you didn't know it, that is me and you. In case you didn't know it, that is me and you.
Man, that brings back so many memories. That's a happy song.
That is a happy song.
And you even said little Anna sitting on Big Tom's knee. Yeah. And that's my daughter at the time was little. Now she's 24, so not much knee sitting these days.
Wow.
Yeah, good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun. So now simultaneously, or let me just get the order correct. You two had a band with two other friends.
I had a band with two friends and I was playing guitar. And then that fateful night at Small World is when I saw Scott, and I think it was like the next day or soon after that when I was like, I'm not playing guitar anymore. Like, this guy should play guitar. I'm going to play bass.
Ah.
And that's how I remember it. It might have been much longer than
that. It might have been that, yeah.
But then you came and played with us.
Tell the name of the band.
The band's called Rana, R-A-N-A. And you joined the band, right, for some gig or something. And I've been in the band ever since.
Yeah. I think I just came and sat in.
Yep,
with
that
you
was
guys
it. Done
somewhere, and then we were a band for like 8 years.
Yep,
from that day on, that was the audition, and I guess
You passed.
I made it.
You passed the audition.
Right.
And I very quickly tried to emulate Matt Cohut, like on bass, you know, just to play, like, because he's my role model for bass playing.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try and keep it simple and keep it solid. And that became my role immediately.
Right. So Rana existed as Amphibian existed.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason they kind of could coexist was because Amphibian's touring schedule was incredibly sparse. And that was sort of the complaint of subsequent versions of Amphibian, as we'll get into, was that the players wanted to take the band and go pro. And meanwhile, I was sort of, you know, young family, young kids, a wife that didn't quite want me to go the music route. And I was also tethered to a desk in a computer job. And
right. We were in college.
You guys were in college.
Yep.
That's right. It wasn't 100% sure that you guys could go on tour either. So,
right. Right.
So you know, we played on weekends and when we could and where we could. And it kind of Rana and Amphibian 1.0 coexisted there for a while.
Yes.
Let's hear a little Rana. Do you guys know a song offhand that you want to play?
I've got a clip of Bicellar Break, which
Great.
Is off of Subject to Change,
mm-hmm.
which was like our second or third record, I think.
Cool.
It's a good one.
Let's hear it. That's a great song, you guys. And Scott, that finally sounds a little more rock than jazz.
I was getting there.
You're getting there.
Yeah, these guys showed me got me into more rocking stuff, taught me a lot about it.
I want to play a couple more Amphibian 1.0 going into Amphibian 2.0 songs, or at least a few clips from there. Now, the thing that happened that turned Amphibian 1.0 into 2.0, do you remember, Andrew?
The addition of Chris Harford.
Yes, and that changed things in many ways.
Chris is a big personality. And I just remember we all sat around the band that was already there, and then Chris was there, and he kind of went, I remember he was running it, and he kind of went to each person and was like, okay, so I get it. You're the piano guy. You write the songs. You sing. You're the lead guitar player. You're the drummer. And he turned to me, and he's like, I don't know what you do.
Oh, man.
And it really threw me back. It's actually one of the most awkward moments of my entire life was that moment. I remember we were sitting on like a picnic table or something. And I was like, I don't know, what do I do? I play guitar, but like, is that not enough? You know, like it was like, it really like set me off for a little while.
It's kind
that
of funny.
Was like, that's, good
that's
example.
Your intro. All right, Scott, how about you? Do you have similar, like the change that occurred?
There was definitely a change. Yeah. Chris came into it and, you know, he had a track record. He had been with Elektra. And I think that, you know, he had been in the music business, which can be a little full contact. And he brought a little bit of that attitude to our thing, which our thing did not have that up to that point.
There was no attitude. We all like loved each other and everything was like, you know,
everything was just awesome. It was
rainbows.
All just so cool and awesome, you know, like as far as we were concerned. And it was, you know.
That's a good way of saying it. There was a little bit of the attitude that Chris had sort of some cynicism from, I believe he got signed possibly by Sony. He had a band called Three Colors.
I think it was on Elektra. Yeah.
Or Elektra. Yeah. And and then he got unsigned. Something weird happened. I don't really quite know that history, but suffice it to say, Chris came with a huge catalog of music. And Chris was really good friends with the Ween guys. And there was sort of like a cynical sort of anti-music industry attitude a little bit that I hadn't really detected before in anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that did happen was immediately we had a following. It was cool.
Right.
And so we suddenly, you know, we played in New Hope, John and Peter's, and packed that place, and it was a great gig. But what was happening, the band a little bit became the Chris Harford band, right? And that kind of happens. Chris had this concept of the Band of Changes.
Right.
And Scott, you've been a big member of that ever since.
For 20 years.
I'm
playing with him this weekend.
Yep. And my friend Matt Cohut can be his bass player. The concept of the Band of Changes is there's musicians out in the world, largely concentrated in this New Jersey area, that know all of Chris's catalog. all of it. And anyone can jump on stage and be in that band. And Chris, with that modus of operation, kind of came into Amphibian, you know, with kind of a take charge attitude a little bit. And sure, yeah, we'll do some of your songs kind of thing, but really we got to learn all these. And so the stage was set for friction to occur between me and Chris right from that first moment. But let's play a couple live clips from Amphibian when Chris showed up. We have Live at the Stone Pony, a couple good songs. Here's a little bit from a song called Back to Mesopotamia. So that was like one of our, you know, rocking songs that we would play kind of to the end of the, toward the end of the show. And that was always a good one and always got people up and dancing.
Right. Yeah.
And that was
what
fun.
What year are we at now with Chris coming in? Like, cause I forget. I it's like 2000.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
I also just want to say, like, cause we were talking about Chris, like Chris also sat down like me and the guys in Rana. And like, I remember this very clearly, putting on Water Boys, Fisherman's Blues, and being like, you guys haven't heard this before, have you? And just schooled us like a couple nights in a row, just like schooled me on so much hard, like awesome music, you know, that I needed to hear.
Yeah.
So like, there's a flip side to the story, which is like, you know, it's keeping things brutally honest, but also like passing on this sort of heavy New Jersey rock knowledge, you know, to the next generation.
No question. Yeah. I mean, the reason that Chris had a following was because he's an awesome musician and his brain, his catalog of music is incredible. And right. I didn't know half the bands that he knew or still
Chris,
don't.
Chris has taught me more about music than I think anybody that I've ever met.
And so there's like, you know, he commanded respect, but deserved it also.
Right.
And so probably wasn't in the right band, right? Amphibian was
That's
probably the problem.
Yeah.
The end of it.
Yeah. Well, like the one thing that I've learned from all the guys that I've played with who were like real sort of like visionary musicians or whatever, who have a vision of what music should be, is that they are big personalities. Yes. Like that's the one thing. And they can be very different types of people, but they all share that in common, is that they're like,
they don't spend a whole lot of time worrying about whether they're creating friction amongst band members.
Right. That's not the priority.
That's
the music
not the
is the priority as far as they're concerned. And I think that, and Chris is no exception to that. You know, he's the same way. And
absolutely. So we toured a bit. We played Stone Pony. That was one of our regular gigs. And then if you had to say another regular gig for us, it was up in Burlington. It was the Higher Ground.
Of course.
So Trey's brother-in-law, Kevin Statzer, opened a club in Burlington, well, actually in Winooski, Vermont, right across the river from Burlington. And it was in a big warehouse, and it was really cool. And he rapidly, to his credit, put Burlington on the map. Normally bands would tour up to Boston and then take a left and go somewhere else.
Right.
Now they had to go all the way up to fucking
Burlington.
It's
a major
stop.
It
became a major stop on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. And to his credit, Higher Ground is still active today.
They moved to a bigger venue many years ago.
Yeah, they upgraded. They became a much bigger room. You can take down a wall and have a really big concert in there now and stuff like that. But that was really fun touring. And every time we went up to Vermont, there was always sort of the hint of a member from Phish sitting in.
Yeah, and it went down. It also happened.
It happened.
It happened.
Yes. It happened more than once with Fishman coming in, mm-hmm. playing drums. It happened more than once with Mike joining us on stage. And it happened more than once with Trey joining us. Now, Paige came to almost every show, but I don't know if he ever came and sat in.
I don't remember him playing.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Sorry, Paige. Maybe I didn't make room for him on the keys. Right? I probably had that one little piano there.
He saw your prowess.
Yeah,
he was like, you know what? Tom's got it.
He was right. Tom, you got it.
I remember when Trey came because he played your white Strat.
No, he played Chris's red Strat.
Oh.
Well, maybe one time he played my white Strat.
I remember it was a Strat, and yeah. I remember thinking like, oh, that's not his normal guitar. Like, that's going to be, like, I'd never seen him play like another guitar.
I remember that we played Farmhouse, and me personally, like, it's selfish of me, but like the thing that I really remember is at the end of it, we both started soloing at the same time. But I don't remember anything about the music at all. The one thing I really remember is when he walked out on stage, I've never heard a crowd... really before or since. Like, it was almost scary, like, how excited everyone was
incredibly excited, and there's capacity at the time of Higher Ground. We sold out, which was pretty cool. I think it might have been 600 or 700 people.
Yeah, it was a small place. I mean,
packed,
it was
awesome.
Oh yeah, totally. And I'm sure that was probably, you know, the smallest space that these
Trey
people
had
seen this guy. Yeah,
yeah, right, exactly.
And I remember I turned around at JP when Trey was walking out. I turned around to our drummer JP, and he had his fingers in his ears. I mean, it was so loud.
It was loud.
Yeah, yeah.
That was cool. Now, do you guys remember anything about any touring, any Amphibian stories, anything interesting happening?
The one thing that one story that I do remember is that I forget where the venue was. I think it was upstate somewhere, but we were playing. And the opening act was a band called Slipknot, which, you know, Grateful Dead fans know there's a famous Grateful Dead song called Slipknot. What the rest of the world knows is that there's an insanely popular heavy metal. I mean, I don't know if you'd even call it heavy metal. I don't even know what you call it.
It's whatever it is. It was weird.
It's so over the top.
Yeah.
And
it's almost like Guar meets Insane.
That's
Clown
a
Posse.
Good. Exactly. That's sort of it. Right. Right. Because they all like sort of like dress up.
They had masks.
They
right?
have like mad mask, like Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome kind of look.
And so did the audience.
Apparently the fans dress up like that too. So I remember it so clearly that, like, in my mind, there were hundreds of kids dressed up like Mad Max characters,
at
you know.
At our show.
And they were all sort of just, like, wandering around the parking lot looking super sad.
Yeah.
Because when they got to the gig, they realized it wasn't their Slipknot.
Yeah, it's
that was
just
playing.
Hippie music.
It was just right.
Which is probably, like, the worst thing that could happen to them.
Yeah, it's, like, beyond disappointing. Just like heartbreakingly.
Maybe country music would have been worse. Maybe.
This was,
I
don't know.
Possibly not.
Neck and neck, for sure.
But that was hilarious. You were talking about upstate. We always had some sort of adventure upstate, right? Where like we were all punchy from being on the road. It was like often like we were either on our way to Higher Ground or on our way back.
Yeah, that was sort of the home base.
And we also played, it was something, it possibly was called the Odyssey in Connecticut, where we had our friend Brendan O'Neill doing sound, and I guess had turned it up too loud.
That's right.
A few gentlemen from the police force came by and basically gave us like a 1 minute warning, with the guy standing there behind Brendan with his arms folded, like, turn it down or else, and then turned us off. Do you remember that?
No.
With no warning. It was just like, we kind of like...
I don't remember that.
Yeah, I remember that.
We kind of like... We were playing 1 minute, and Brendan was like flagging us. Like, then I was like, yeah, whatever. And all of a sudden, boom, there's no sound. That was pretty intense.
And then the three of us went out and did an encore.
Yeah, we did a little harmony thing.
With just you playing acoustic guitar. No mics or PA or anything. We just walked
we
to the end of the stage.
Terrible thing about hell.
Was
you know what I mean?
Wow.
Like a little harmony
yeah.
that we had.
Right.
A little Olivia's Pool, maybe something else. that we had ready to go. But
that's I don't remember that, and that is an awesome story.
Yeah. I remember Chris got mad and like just stormed like into the back, and I don't know what he was doing back there, but he was pissed. That was pretty interesting.
Do you remember we used to play Bug? I think we were the first to play Bug, right?
Oh yeah. There was.
And we were playing it all fucked up, and then I remember Matt Kohut being like, "Guys, it's you do nothing on the one." So it's like one. Bug, right? Yeah. I just remember that so clearly. He like taught the band like how to do it, like bug, don't beat it, right? And then ever since I've heard that song being played by Phish and stuff, I always think of it like one, two, or one and that anticipation, like that's the key to that whole song.
It is,
He just explained it so clearly.
Yeah, that's great. It was kind of nice every now and then, like you know. A couple of people really did know music really well, and a couple of us were a little bit more fumbling around, like me. And it's kind of nice every now and then having someone like Matt, you know, tell us
MD
which way to go.
MD,
yeah. So Scott, I'd love to talk about sort of like the next phase in your music, because at that point, Amphibian ran its course,
right,
and we all kind of went our separate ways. And honestly, to my detriment, I lost track of you for probably more than 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And in that 10 years, you've been through a lot of really cool bands.
Busy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
How would you characterize sort of like, could you talk us through that and play some of that music?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, you know, when Amphibian stopped playing, Rana, which both me and Andrew were in, we gave it a shot. I mean, we went on the road for 6 years, 5 years.
For a while, yeah. Around the country many times.
You guys had something going with Wetlands for a while too, right?
Yeah, we were sort of the last or one of the last bands to kind of come up through the ranks. You know, you start in the basement and then you start playing, what is it, Thursday nights or something upstairs. And then we would play for a long time. So I remember so many times leaving that venue when the sun's coming up.
Yeah,
and it was just like this great thing. And then 9/11, so what is that, 2001, right? That sort of shut that place down. And we were looking for a home, and we were also touring. So it was an interesting time.
And when the Wetlands closed, some of the staff came with us and became like the booking agent at the Wetlands.
Right.
When the Wetlands closed, he became Rana's manager.
Was he Snufarowski or something?
Jake Snufarowski.
Yeah.
Yeah. There were a bunch of guys that have gone on to do other stuff.
There are people whose names I knew from back then,
right,
who now I see out with. Yeah,
well, we were like our thing, and I hate to talk about it in the past, but because it's irrelevant. Like a rock and roll jam band. So when Wetlands closed, we pretty much jumped over to CBGB's. You know, like because that was like that's a rock venue. That's a legitimate like a mono, you know, PA, like just a rock and roll venue where a lot of our heroes had played anyway.
Yeah.
So to take improvisation and bring it there made a lot of sense for us. And then we would play that kind of venue all around the country. So places, what was the place in Birmingham? The Nick.
The Nick in Birmingham. You know, yeah, it was
rock rooms.
Real rock rooms. Yeah, totally. And we played New Year's Eve. We were like the house band for New Year's Eve at CBGB's.
Couple years.
For like the last 3 or 4 years that place was open, I think.
On the drive down here, I was thinking about the story that I'm going to like give to you. We're at a festival at the Peach Festival or something like that.
No, it was Langerado in Florida. The first Langerado Festival in Florida.
Well, we're on stage. We're playing at like 3 o'clock. You know, James Brown is going to headline at like 9. There's no reason for anyone. You know how these things go. Like those people don't show up until like, you know,
8:59.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's 3 o'clock in the morning or three in the afternoon. It's the sun is beating down. There's a good crowd, but like, and we're playing our rock music and we look over and James Brown is on the side of the stage. And I'm going to let Scott tell the story because he's got ownership of this one.
Well, I missed it. I missed seeing it. But Andrew came over to me while we were playing and he was like, "This is the craziest thing. This is unbelievable. I can't believe this is happening." And I didn't see what was happening. So I was like, I had no idea what he was talking about.
You thought it was like he was like, praising your amazing solo.
Andrew's really into it. Like that. You know, like, that's all I knew. And so we finished packing up and Andrew came over to me and he was like, "That might have been the coolest moment of my life." And I was like, what? Like it was good, but I didn't think it was that good, you know? And he's like, "Oh man, you know, you missed it. James Brown was on the side of the stage while we were playing busting full on Sex Machine dance moves to our set, to our music. God. So we made James Brown like do his thing. We made him happy.
That is great.
And then okay, we'll keep going back and forth.
The whole setup is then like, didn't you like run into him at, like?
The way I remember it is that there was a guy that, a security guy came up to me saying that he would like, that Mr. Brown, you know, and it was clearly a security guy. He was in a three-piece suit and everything, and he had an earpiece in, and he said that Mr. Brown would like to meet us. You know?
Wow.
And we ended up going backstage, and there he was. We met the man himself. And he was like super complimentary about our set and like telling us how much he liked our thing.
That's fantastic. You
know? It was amazing. And it became like, it was like just like classic James. He was just as James Brown as you want him to be. You know, he was like, oh, that guitar playing. He's like, it's frightening. Frightening guitar player. You know? And then it got into like, you know, because we were in Florida and it was so hot. And he was like, oh, it's so hot down here. I need a shower, you know?
Like, oh, full on, like, remember it was like blue hair. Like he had full on, it was weird dye job. It was like blue, right?
Wow.
Yeah, he was sweating, dark, you know? Like it was just so awesome. Such a great moment Rana history.
I mean, you know.
Yeah. I don't love, you guys got a picture.
We didn't get a picture.
Damn it.
And it's one of like the biggest regrets of my life because that's going to be tough to top. I mean, that might be the greatest compliment any of us will ever get, you know, in our lives. Like,
that's a great one.
Yeah.
That's a great one. That one's hard to, well, I mean, always keep going because you might get another one, you know?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
right. So we toured around for a long while.
Yeah.
And then the band sort of like slowed down.
Yeah.
I mean, we can not go into that. And then you went on to do other awesome things.
I stayed busy. Yeah. I mean, well, after Rana stopped playing, I wasn't quite sure what to do. And I got an offer from a band on the West Coast called Particle, which was a very popular jam band.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that.
Yeah, they were a thing. And I went out there, and that didn't exactly work out. It lasted about a year or so, and I came home. I kind of came to the conclusion I'm not made for the West Coast. You know,
you came in there with an East Coast attitude, didn't you?
I sure did. I can't help it, Tom. And when I, so yeah, for my trajectory, like when I came home, I took a few years and I actually just taught people how to play guitar because I was sort of burned out. I had basically been playing music for 10 years at that point, pretty much nonstop. And, you know,
kind of didn't have a big break yet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And that can be sort of like, that's the musician's conundrum. Like,
yes.
Do I continue doing this?
Or? Well, it was really frustrating, frankly, you know? And I was kind of like, I was doing all the stuff right. I knew I sounded pretty good, you know? And, and I just sort of said, all right, well, I'm just going to kind of hang in New York for a minute and just teach. I ended up teaching at a place called School of Rock, which then became, you know, a big thing.
It became the School of Rock. Multiple schools all across the country.
Yeah, it became a huge
thing. And a movie made of it.
Yeah, and a Broadway show.
Oh, my God.
It's a whole thing.
That's so cool.
It's a whole thing. So I taught there for about 3 years without doing many gigs. I would still do gigs with friends, like, you know, smaller stuff, playing with, like, Chris Hartford, like we're talking about, playing with his Band of Changes and stuff around. And I still did stuff with my friends Joe, Dave, and Marco. We had a instrumental Zeppelin thing called Bustle in Your Hedgerow.
Yeah. Now, when you say Joe.
When I say Joe.
You're talking about Joe Russo.
I'm talking about Joe Russo.
So now there was a PDS connection there too, kind of, right? Did that sort of?
The connection is really easy. Remember the Wetlands nights?
Yes.
Rana would play in the basement.
Yes.
Our friend Joe would come to watch because Joe's was in Fat Mama at the time. Or maybe they had, I think they're still in Fat Mama. And my friend from Princeton, Pooja, a lot of my friends from Princeton Day School would come, and Scott knows all these people as well, would come to see us play Wetlands, like a cool night out, right? Right. And I remember many times Joe being like, who is this Indian girl? Like, she is so beautiful. I have to meet her. And that was it. And then
they're married.
They got together and then they're married. Children. Yeah.
Beautiful
child. So Princeton Day School connection is in JRAD as well, which is cool.
Yep.
Princeton Day School is everywhere, you guys.
There's no escape from you guys.
Is that how you remembered it? I feel like I just remembered it being so linear.
100% accurate. Yeah, they met at the, I mean, I think that they met at the Wetlands at a mm-hmm. Rana show. Yeah. It's a really small world. Random. The music scene is such a small world once you get in there, because Rana and the duo did a bunch of touring together.
Oh, cool.
Where Rana would open for the duo.
Oh, I did not know that. Yeah. That's great. That's really cool. So Bustle in Your Hedgerow, do you have any clips?
I sure do.
Sweet. What song? Come on.
Yeah, maybe Heartbreaker. Maybe we'll listen to a little bit of Heartbreaker.
So we should say, or you guys, it's about to become painfully obvious, Bustle in Your Hedgerow, the line from Stairway to Heaven,
right,
was a Zeppelin cover band. Did you guys sing at all, though?
We've never sang. Well, there's one exception. Dave, if we play Hot Dog, Dave sings Hot Dog. The band started with just me, Joe, and Marco as a trio for a few years.
And none of you are really singers,
right,
so to speak.
Right. That's not like in our like foundation, our musical foundations. And then a few years, so we were just playing an instrumental, Marco playing the bass lines with his left hand. And a few years into it, I told Joe and Marco, I was like, you know, my friend Dave, who plays in Ween, knows more about Zeppelin than everybody in this room put together, which is really saying something.
Yeah.
Too. And I bet that he would like love to come and play with us.
And yeah. step up the game big time with a real bass player.
Exactly. Free up Marco's thing, you know, and just like have like a bass player. And Dave's like the quintessential rock bassist.
Dave Drywitz we're talking about, who's just an amazingly if you throw out his musical talent completely, he is also just the nicest person in the world.
He's shockingly nice.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like a terrible person after I hang out with Dave Drywitz. You know?
But he also happens to be an unbelievable bass player, and he and I share the same favorite bass player.
Which is?
Can you guess?
Paul McCartney.
Yes. Good guess.
Great.
Yeah. So anyway, Dave joined Bustle in Your Hedgerow, and now we're going to hear a little bit of that.
Yes.
All right.
So, and then, so for a bunch of years, I was just kind of being a freelance New York City session guy. And I played with everybody from like country bands to soul bands to jazz groups to singer-songwriters. And I went all over the world playing with these people. I toured all over Europe, all over Asia, all over Australia over the course of like 5 or 6 years. I was
kind of just getting hired on as a touring band guitarist.
Totally, like guy in the back, you know, like totally not in the spotlight. The last gig that I did before J-Rad started to pick up, there were, it was a 90 minute set, and we would play the same set every single night, and there was not one guitar solo in the show. So I was in a completely different headspace when J-Rad started to.
That's called just earning a paycheck.
Yeah, it was, Well, it was really satisfying. I mean, I thought it was great music, and it actually taught me a lot about just being contributing to the sound of a band and getting your ego totally out of the way.
Oh, cool.
Like, because I can play guitar, but there was no need for it in the music, you know?
You're not going to get a spotlight on you, ever.
Right.
So do your best as a backing musician.
Yeah, which actually taught me, I'm so glad that I had those years. Those years, I maybe learned more about being a musician in those years.
That's cool.
Than I, in any other point in my life.
Right, because so much before that was like, and now for the solo.
Yeah. You know
what I mean? A lot of that music has that, right?
Yes, that's right. That's right. And all through it, I've always had a love of Django Reinhardt, which was a gypsy jazz guitarist from the 40s. And kind of the reason that we're sitting here, I started a group that plays that music with Katie Jacoby and Simon Kafka. And we're called the Showdown Kids, and we play gypsy jazz. And we recorded a version of Stash by the band Fish, and I sent it to you.
It's an amazing version.
And that's what put us back in touch. Really?
That's what put you and me back in touch.
Yeah, because I recorded it, and I was sitting there, and I was like, I should really reach out to Tom and send him this, because I bet he'd love to hear it.
I'm so glad you did. And since then, we've gone to concerts together, we've hung out, and now we're podcasting.
Now we're podcasting. Who knows what's next?
Let's hear, yeah, exactly. Maybe Amphibian 5.0. Let's hear Stash. That's just beautiful.
Thanks,
now,
man.
What's the name of that band? Sorry.
That's called the Showdown Kids.
Okay.
And that's actually the first time anybody's ever heard any bit of that recording.
Oh, wow.
We just recorded it a couple of months ago, and it'll be released later this fall.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, maybe Trey will hear that one, I hope.
Hey, I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you have another band called Wolf, right?
I do.
What happened there? What's going on with that?
What's going on with that? That's sort of, I've always had a love of Telecaster playing, which, if you don't know about what a Telecaster is, it's sort of a very specific way of playing the guitar. I guess, you know, the roots of it are in country music.
Was it Chet Atkins or something? Or
Chet Atkins is he didn't actually play a Telecaster, but it's closely related. Okay. No, you're not far off at all. It's kind of like a very twangy sound. Some of the guys that, you know, that have influenced me on the Telecaster would be like Roy Buchanan and Danny Gatton. And these are some of the guys that are the greatest guitar players to ever live, really. And for some reason, really grown-up guitar players tend to gravitate towards the Telecaster.
I noticed, like, and I'm sure that he doesn't play it for the reasons that you do, but like people like Bruce Springsteen play a Tele, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And Keith Richards.
Oh.
And but it's different. They do it differently, you know?
They do it rock, like whatever.
Well, the Telecaster was the very first electric guitar. It was the very first model that Leo Fender ever made.
Oh.
So there's sort of like this purity to it, you know? And it's nothing fancy. It doesn't look like sexy, and there's no like fancy, you know, decorations or costuming on it. It's like a very functional slab of wood with two knobs on it.
And that's your axe.
And you can either play it or you can't.
That's main axe.
Yeah, for the most part, yeah.
Awesome, yeah. Awesome.
And so anyway, so Wolf is a trio, bass, drums, and guitar, all instrumental again. And it's kind of my tribute to, you know, trying to be a guy in a Telecaster lineage, I guess.
Awesome. So you're kind of keeping the Telecaster history going.
I'm doing what I can.
And let's hear a little bit of Wolf. Great. So Scott, thanks for kind of taking me through sort of, at least in my history of you, kind of a dark spot where I didn't quite know what you have been up to. Mm-hmm. I was happy that you found yourself in New York City and were able to, you know, maintain these amazing connections, and eventually something awesome came of it. Now, the first time, I mean, I kind of started hearing a little bit about J-Rad. You know, there's connections and people start, you know, saying this band's really good, Tom, you got to go see them, that kind of thing. But prior to that, Trey was getting ready to be the guitarist for the Grateful Dead's 50th reunion.
Right. The ultimate jam band gig.
Ultimate jam band gig that just like everyone in the Dead community and the Fish community couldn't believe was happening and yet was simultaneously incredibly excited for out in Chicago. And Trey, you know, there are a lot of accounts of how seriously Trey took it and how honored he was. But very few people know really what that means with Trey. And Trey is a monster when it comes to studying stuff and getting ready for stuff. Mm. And he dropped everything and put all his energy into it. And I'm talking, he went through the very, very earliest. He kind of went into Jerry's, everything that exists from Jerry's history and kind of learned to play chronologically as Jerry was playing. You mentioned Django Reinhardt. Trey was in he was telling me he was listening to something. He's like, oh my God, Jerry must have just been listening to Django Reinhardt.
He could hear the influence.
He could hear it.
Right.
And then, so then Trey goes and listens to Django Reinhardt and learns that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like follow the breadcrumbs backwards. Yeah,
precisely,
sure.
Precisely. So finally, you know, and I don't want to speak for him because he didn't tell me all this. I'm filling a bit of it in, just knowing him over the years very well. But my guess is that finally he kind of came to the point where he was done sort of studying by himself. And he got this guy, I believe he met through Broadway, an incredible keyboard player, and by all accounts, a guy that can kind of play all the parts of the band. So Trey needed, now let's play this stuff that I've learned. Let me now play, you know, the Jerry role with another person just to start feeling what it's going to be like playing it live. He did that for a while with this guy, Jeff Tansky, keyboard player. And then I think, and you can tell me if I'm wrong because you were involved in part two of this, I think Trey then was like, you know what, this is great, but maybe it's time to play with a full band. And so what happened next?
Well, at some point, I don't know what his thinking was behind it, but at some point he called Joe Russo. Now, Trey and Joe had been in Grab together. With Marco Benevento and Mike Gordon.
That's
how they knew each other, right? So there's a connection there. And Joe had, since Grab, had gotten the Further gig.
Right.
Okay, which was Joe and Phil Lesh and Bob Weir. And, you know, so he had been fully immersed into the Grateful Dead scene.
Ah.
And so I'm sure that Trey's thinking was like, well, who do I know that really knows the Dead book that I could play with?
Who might be in New York City.
Who might also be in New York City. And...
good call.
And Joe Russo fits the bill. So he called Joe. And as I understand it, the three of them, Jeff, Joe, and Trey, played at a rehearsal space for a day or two. And Joe, at some point, I believe, brought up the idea of bringing me and Dave into it.
And J-Rad was a thing at this point.
It was. Okay. It was a new thing, but it was a thing.
Okay. So suddenly, Trey was playing with three members of J-Rad.
That's correct.
Wow. I don't know if anyone knows that.
I don't know. I don't know how much of this is out there, you know?
That's pretty cool.
I don't know. It was really cool. For me, it was amazing to watch as a guitar player So anyway, let me back up. So we went up to the rehearsal space, which was on the upper west side. And we spent 3 days, I think it was, playing long days. You know, we're talking like, you know, 8 hours or something in a little sort of, it was awesome. Like a little, like, not too comfortable rehearsal room, mm-hmm. you know, and just banging out these tunes.
How many people were there? It was like the four of you or five of you and engineer?
There was no one else.
That was it.
There was no one else. Five
and you're like stopping the tunes, and he's like, oh, the bridge is there, right? And he like writes it down.
It would be different things, like the way that, I mean, he was clearly taking this extremely seriously, you know, as you would imagine. And some of the tunes, the Dead Songbook is interesting because it has, it covers a lot of bases. Some of the tunes are kind of folk tunes. And if you know the chords, you can just play through the tune and you can be like, okay, great, I know that song. And then move on. And then there's other things that it's like, it almost gets into like prog rock territory.
Weird parts and shit.
Yeah. And, you know, and a lot of that stuff fell on the Garcia guitar parts.
Ah.
And it's like a lot of those tunes have guitar parts that like you have to know, because if you don't, if it's not in there,
you're not
everyone
leading the band
there,
right
you're yeah. not doing it right. And yeah. everyone there is going to know
yes.
that it's not there. So some of the tunes we would just play through and it would be like, great, we got that one, sounded great, you know, moving on, you know. And then other tunes, we would play the tune up to a certain point, and then he would, you know, the song Slipknot comes to mind. This is a very sort of involved guitar run in the middle of it. And it was, we just kind of played the tune up to there, and then he just wanted to loop that part just over and over and over again for a long time for him to get
meaning,
it under his
fingers. Meaning have the band loop... in other words, the band.
Yeah, just take a like it was like a 16 bar section, and just only play those 16 bars over and over and over.
As the live band, you were playing it. It wasn't like something that he right. put on a recorder and just played.
No, he had us. That's what we were there for.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Wow.
And you're playing rhythm guitar during this, or yes. Would you also play the lines? You didn't need to, I suppose.
I wouldn't need to. I mean, you know.
Is there harmony here and there that you play?
There's harmonies that we would do. But like we would also kind of like, we wanted to keep it interesting for him and us. So like sometimes I would play the harmony, or sometimes I would play the chords, or like, you know, sometimes Joe would like throw in a drum thing that would like sort of surprise everybody. Because it can get sort of, you know, when you're just focused in a little room for hours and hours, you know, you got to keep it fun.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be fun, you know, at the end of the day.
And, well, that begs a question. Did you guys, well, like, so J-Rad is known for taking Dead jams into places that the Dead wouldn't have.
Yeah.
Did you guys go there in that room? Did that ever
happen? I'd say yes.
Yes?
I'd say yes. I mean, I'll put it this way. Like, there were times where, you know, we would just sort of say, okay, let's just, like, play for a little bit, just to kind of, like, it was like musical ginger, you know, like clear the palate for a second and just like jam and just like get it out of your system. And we would jam and we would, when at the end of the jam, we'd stop and everybody would just be like cracking up laughing because it felt so good. You know, it felt like we did something new together. Like we made a musical statement together.
That's cool.
And I think, you know, you got three guys from J-Rad. So of course the sound of our thing is going to come through. You can't help that.
Were the words ever said, like, you know, when you were done, like, that jam is likely never to occur on the Grateful Dead stage?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes. Like, that probably won't happen.
Right.
Well, because, like, we're also, you know, like, we got into, like, a Sabbath-sounding thing. And it's like, I just don't see it happening, you know? You know what I mean?
Bad looks from Bob Weir.
Now, you know, these tapes probably won't come out ever.
I don't, you know, I honestly don't know.
I would love them to, but I have to ask, just to fully put myself in the room, did you guys sing too? Or was only Trey kind of singing?
No, we were absolutely singing. Oh. I mean, I feel like my role there is in a big part was to help him out with the Bob Weir songs.
Oh.
And so in J-Rad, I sing the Bob Weir songs.
You're the Bobby part.
I'm like the Bobby vocal guy.
Yeah.
And, those songs can be tricky if you're just playing the chord progression with no sort of road signs.
I see.
With the vocals.
Oh, totally.
Letting you know where you're at.
So you have to, for it to be useful, you have to put the vocals on.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Amazing.
And so I personally did a lot of singing in those because I don't think that he had had the chance. I don't know, but I got the feeling that he was hitting some of the Bobby tunes for the first time because he didn't have anybody to do.
Okay. Well, that's amazing. Well, thank you for your role in that because the result was so fucking incredible. I mean, I'm not over it yet, sort of.
Unbelievable. It was very cool to watch segments of that. I didn't go to the concert because I was playing, but it was very cool to watch the result of all that work, like to have been a fly on the wall and to kind of like we were talking about the other day, like I felt like I was like a sparring partner for like the heavyweight champ, like getting ready for the big fight.
Yeah.
You know?
You're that guy holding up those like punch this, you know, those big gloves.
Yeah, like with the headgear and everything, you know, just like getting the hell beat out of them, you know, for the greater good.
That metaphor works until you imagine Trey like actually punching, because I can't.
Yeah, no, that makes two of us. Yeah, it's hard to picture.
Well, that's amazing. Well, let's talk now. That leaves the last band, because it's your current band, J-Rad.
J-Rad.
What do you have to say about J-Rad? I mean, everyone knows J-Rad, that you guys are... It's a huge band. It got huge fast.
We are just as surprised as anybody.
Really?
Is the best thing that I can say. Well, you know, I mean, the truth of the background is that it was going to be one gig.
Seriously? Where was the gig?
At Brooklyn Bowl.
Oh, wow.
And we were going to play. There's this annual party in the city for live music fans called the New York City Freaks Ball. And we were asked to play... one night of Grateful Dead music, and we all said, great, you know, like, sounds like fun, let's do it. And we did one show, and that was in January of 2013. And the response that the show had gotten through the course, the months after the gig, was so overwhelming. You know, the tape got downloaded just like, so many times.
People were blown away.
Everywhere that I was going that year, people were like, you got to do that Dead thing again. You know, I don't know if we had even called it Joe Russo's Almost Dead yet or what, you know.
Is it because you took the jams to a place that no one kind of had heard before?
That's what I'm told. Yeah.
And because you nonetheless treated it with respect.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's very... It's amazing.
It's a fine line with music, just in general, of having like treating something sacred,
yes,
and then having, and then also not being too afraid to put your thing on it. You know what I mean? To make it your own.
That's kind of exactly what I meant by respect.
Right. You have to have respect.
You can't do it. You can't do it wrong, or it's going to sound awful. Right. Or be interpreted, you know, awfully.
Right, but you also don't want it to sound like that you're just trying to sound, or we don't want it to sound like, I think that I can speak for everybody in the band, we don't want it to sound like that. None of us are interested in trying to sound like somebody else.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
And that's the comment that I hear the most, is that, you know, it's really like the ultimate, it really means a lot when people come up to us, or me, or whatever, all of us, after the gigs, and they're like, you know, I saw the Dead 300 times, and the energy that you guys have is the first time that I've felt it since 95.
Energy is a good word, because you guys also, like, you turn the tempo up with no question.
Well, that's all Russo. I mean, Russo gets full credit for the whole thing, you know? I mean, Russo's...
But the tempo is higher. It's not like... It's no longer sort of like, to me, like Americana, rootsy. Now it's sort of like... It's got sort of a modern, faster feel. Would you... agree with that?
Yes, I think so. Yeah. Well, you know, at the end of the day, I think a lot of the guys in the band are kind of Jersey metal kids. We grew up listening to heavy metal from Jersey, and that's part of us.
That's awesome.
And we're playing a songbook. Singing in the band was a big thing, because I hadn't sang in a band since Rana, which at that point had been like 10 years.
It's been a while, right?
And you know, we got very, very lucky with the range of Bob Weir songs, sitting exactly in a spot that's very comfortable for me to sing in my vocal range. It is really just like a super happy accident. And one of the tunes is that I really enjoy doing is, I enjoy doing them all, but, Feels Like a Stranger is a great example of that, I think.
Oh, great. Well, let's hear that.
Let's give a listen. Your eyes tell mama you mean them too.
Now, the other members of the band, you are with a couple of longtime old friends.
Actually, everybody's old longtime friends. Oh, okay. Me, Joe, Marco, and Dave have done more stuff together over the years.
And what's the Jerry guitarist, so to speak?
Tom Hamilton.
Okay, Tom Hamilton. All right.
Yep.
So that's great. And you guys kind of, in a way, like, are doing things differently than the Dead did.
I think that that's one of the big things, is that there's sort of essentially two lead guitar players happening.
Opposed to the Dead, which is all Jerry.
Right, which is a big difference.
Right.
You know, immediately that just sets up the sonic palette to be...
Is there ever a feeling that Joe needs... I mean, he's such a big drum player. Do you think the Mickey Hart... personality is missing at all?
I don't know what that means, the Mickey Hart personality.
You know, the other percussionist in the Dead.
Because Joe can do whatever he wants. He can play like two guys simultaneously when he wants to.
It's
mind-blowing.
So Andrew and Scott, I know you're on your way somewhere south right now. Where are you headed?
I am. As soon as we're done here, I'm getting in the car and going to Lochan, which is a big festival in Virginia.
It is. The last big festival I went to was canceled. Let's hope for better luck for you guys.
Jeez, yeah.
That was brutal. That was incredible. I don't think the fish community is over that yet. Curveball cancellation.
What? Yeah.
That was some craziness.
We heard about it when we were at soundcheck.
Everyone heard about it. It just
felt so terrible.
It's really
everybody.
Yeah. Well, good luck down there. And you don't play today, do you?
No. No.
Okay.
We play. J-Rad plays Thursday and Friday nights.
Okay.
And then I'm doing a set with Chris Harford on Friday afternoon. And on Saturday afternoon, me and Eric Krasno are doing a duo set down there. So
wonderful.
Busy weekend, full docket.
Yeah. That's awesome. That sounds great. Well, I'm going to let you get on the road, and I really want to thank you, Andrew Southern. Thank you very much for coming here.
Welcome.
And helping me interview this very difficult subject.
Yeah.
Scott, thank you very much, Scott. Thank you really for coming here on your way down south, and best of luck, and see you soon, man.
Thanks. It's great to see you guys, really. Osiris.
This podcast is In the Loop, the Legion of Osiris podcasts. Osiris is creating a community that connects people like you with live experiences and podcasts about artists and topics you love. Get in the loop at osirispod.com.